This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
You might actually be the most derivative one of all. I mean, Christ, the same house.
Maybe so. But you forgot the first rule of surviving a stab movie. Never answer the...
I'm bored.
Wait!
And welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking creating a medical emergency. We're talking wild practical effects from a low-budget indie. And we're talking, I never dreamed this thing turned into a menage a trois. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace. And we're talking, it's okay. We're cutting your arm off.
Trace, I forgot about that moment. And that moment goes so fucking hard.
It's so hard, but also that line delivery is so funny. Everyone, we are discussing Toby Wilkins' 2008 gem of an indie film, Splinter. And man, Joe, I gotta say, this movie held up for me.
Yeah, I was actually really worried because when you and I got off the mic at the end of the last episode, we were both so excited that we were going to cover this film because we both really like it. But then that creeping little bit of doubt got into my mind. I thought, what if it's not as good as you remember? Because I've only seen it the one time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. I loved it. It's still fantastic.
That's my question to you, though. It's like, because I shockingly saw this in theaters when
what?
It came out.
Really?
I know. I was looking at the box office. I mean, like, so according to Box Office Mojo, this film opened in 4 screens on October 31st, 2008. And I was like,
how did you see it then?
Well, and here's the thing, though. It was playing, so next to UT Austin campus, there was a mall. And it was like, even by 2008, it was like, it was a shitty-ass mall. It was kind of, it looked like the Dawn of the Dead mall, where it's like, there's no one here.
Okay.
And they had a movie theater called the Dolby Theater, and it had like 6 screens in it. And it was just like, you know, rinky-dink, shitty, like, oh, had that kind of mildewy smell.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, Splinter was playing there for one weekend, that Halloween weekend, and I went to go see it.
That's wild. Were you just like, oh, it's a creature feature, I'm going, I don't care?
You know, I think I had read about it on Bloody. I don't... Shit. I actually don't know if it screened at any festivals or not, but I remember reading articles about it on Bloody, and I just saw Creature Feature, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go see this movie. And I think the review was fairly positive. I mean, when we go into the reception, this film did get a relatively strong positive reception.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was 19, 20 at the time. I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go walk to this theater that's right across campus and go see this Creature Feature. And I was not disappointed.
Ugh, isn't it wild? Those old days, like, I've had conversations with former guest Lindsay Travs about how there were times in our youth, I'm using youth with air quotes here.
Yes,
there were times where we would just, like, randomly roll up at a movie theater and be like, what's playing? Let's go watch something. Like, that was a thing that people of a certain generation would do. Maybe the kids still do it nowadays, but I feel like it's so much harder to find a weird little gem when you go to a multiplex now, because it's just like 25 screens all showing the same 3 or 4 movies, right?
Yeah, you've got to look for those smaller. It's not even an indie theater, but it's a theater that plays those indie films. Like, I remember there was another one in Austin. I was like, oh, I'm going to go see the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I'm going to go see the Girl Who Played with Fire, because that was the only theater showing those at the time. And those would be the fun ones where I was like, okay, let's just show up and see what the next showtime is, and we'll go see some random. And, you know, because I think when you're younger and you're seeing a foreign film, or an independent film, you're like, ooh, I'm classy going to see these movies.
I'm taking a huge risk right now. I should be applauded.
But yeah, I mean, like, even in the days of yore, you know, we had movie phone or we had newspapers to, like, read movie times. And so today we just don't have that. Sorry, we do have it because it's literally at the tip of our finger wherever we go.
Mm-hmm. I guess the difference feels like your exposure to some of these secret little you know, you called this a gem off the top, and I would agree with that. I think there's going to be a bunch of people who listen to this episode having either never seen this movie, never heard of this movie, or they're going to be so fucking excited that we're covering it because they're part of that small little group who champions it.
Right.
But it also feels like it's harder to discover these things. Like, I think we really rely on word of mouth now. You know, somebody writes a little listicle and we look at number 8 and realize, ooh, that sounds intriguing. Maybe I'll seek it out.
Well, but I attribute a lot of that, though, to oversaturation, because while you and I have both said we will never complain about having an endless supply of horror films to watch, it's difficult because, yeah, it is hard to find those gems. So that's where, honestly, and not to toot our own horns, but people like us or genre critics or regular critics come in to be like, yeah, I watched all this shit and here's 3 good ones.
I spared you the expense. You can learn from my lesson. Avoid these ones and watch these ones.
Exactly. Now, I will say, I was a little surprised because I posted I was watching this on my socials, as I sometimes do, and so many people were like, oh my god, I'm so glad you're covering this. And I went to Letterboxd and I saw so many people reviewing this movie back in October of last year, and they were watching it for the first time. And so I was like, maybe it hit Shudder or some streaming service or something, because it usually seems to be when people start rediscovering older, and I'm using older in quotes, since 2008.
Right.
Little smaller films. But I mean, clearly it found an audience for some reason in October of last year.
That is wild. Yeah. I couldn't remember if I owned this movie, because I have a kind of deep bench catalog of movies that I more or less stole from Blockbuster in the final closing days, where, you know, you would go and you could get 10 movies for $10 or something like that. So I just grabbed anything that looked interesting. And this for me was of a time period where there was still that kind of air of questionability about direct-to-video movies. Like, sometimes you might find a splinter, but sometimes you might find, I don't know, insert generic title X, where you're like, oh, it's Dancing Arachnophobes Volume 8 or something.
Mega Piranha.
Yeah. And so it often felt like you were taking a risk, but, you know, in those times, it was kind of like, well, the prices are so cheap. Like, it really doesn't matter if I just happen to have a new coaster, if this goes badly.
A new coaster. How dare you, sir?
All that to say, this for me was just like a random Blockbuster rental, because I would kind of peruse the aisles, walk around, take a look at what was on the shelf, and anything that kind of caught my eye, I would just sort of grab. But it's weird because I remembered watching this movie in the early 2000s, so I don't know why I would have stumbled onto it, because it would have been obviously quite a bit later than that. It probably would have been closer to like 2010, which is not when I was doing a lot of renting at that point, because I was like, well, basically my ex had stopped working at Blockbuster, so my access had been cut off.
Oh, that's really funny, because I had started working at Blockbuster like a year after this movie came out, and I remember like the shelf. It didn't have its own like wall, but it had its own row of boxes. So
nice.
Definitely one I recommended to people. Actually, question for you, because why are we covering this movie for queer stuff? Because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, director Toby Wilkins is a queer man.
Yes, and I can't remember how we discovered it, because when I went searching to find it, I couldn't find any kind of notification. It's not listed on his Wikipedia or his IMDb. There's no articles on it. But yeah, I remember at one point you and I stumbled on this because he's also the director of The Grudge 3.
Yes.
So we thought, okay, well, now we can cover those two films unquestionably.
And I'm sorry, brief aside about The Grudge 3. I remember thinking The Grudge 3 was actually fine for a straight-to-DVD J-horror sequel, especially when The Grudge 2 was as abominable as
horrible.
It was.
Yeah.
People have told me that I'm wrong in that assessment.
Oh, no.
I've only seen it the one time, but I remember being like, oh, it's fine. And it has Shawnee Smith in it, and it is a direct sequel to The Grudge 2. So, I mean, like, it's not like a standalone film.
Right. It's no Hostel 3.
Oh, God. See, that's your movie. That's the one where it's like, I can get a splinter or I can get a Hostel 3.
But at least with Hostel, I recognize the title, and it still says Eli Roth Presents.
Oh, my God. But yeah, so whether or not Toby Wilkins is queer, I agree with you. I know that we found that tidbit somewhere, but this could have been, what, 2 years ago when we were still planning things? Nevertheless, even if Toby Wilkins is not queer, everyone, this is a very good movie. It's not quite micro-budget, but, and I couldn't find an exact number, but it seems to me the budget for this film falls somewhere around $700,000. And
wow. Okay.
When you look at this film, I mean, look, we can talk about the shaky cam all you want. It doesn't really bother me in this movie, but I get for some people that it does. This movie is a treasure trove of outstanding practical effects on a very, very, very limited budget.
Yeah. I will definitely cop to the fact that I remembered seeing more than we actually do. I think we still see plenty. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we are using the camera as well as the editing to disguise how little we can move this creature, or rather how we can make it move. So there is a certain kind of music video editing style at play here.
Yeah.
And I can certainly appreciate that if people come in because we've been gushing about how good the practical effects are, and then they say, well, I can't fucking see anything.
Right.
That's a bit of a legitimate claim. It was shakier and faster paced editing than I remembered. But at the same time, when you're seeing this creature, like, it is fucking scary, and it looks great.
Oh, it absolutely does. And you know, I don't have a huge, I don't really have a production history for us, because apparently this movie had no issues. It was a really easy road to get there. No troubles on set, really. But so I have fun little factoids that I'll probably sprinkle in through our plot. But yeah, this creature is all prosthetics and makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly played by a gymnast named Jamie Henderson, who spent a couple weeks, like, you know, basically like learning or teaching himself or creating the flips and movements of the creature to give it its own personality.
Right.
And then the first victim of the creature, the gas station attendant played by Charles Baker, he had a lot of experience in mime training, which is where his interpretation of the creature's movements came from.
Hmm. Okay, I can see it.
But yeah, so I mean, like, honestly, like, but with CGI, like, there is very little CGI here. I'll point out the very few brief moments that there are. There's, like, one shot that actively looks bad, mm-hmm. but it's just that. It's a split-second shot.
Right. Okay.
Creature effects, by the way, handled by Quantum Creative Effects, who weren't really familiar to me, but mm-hmm. This is the film they worked on right before they went off to go work on Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's interesting. That's a huge step up. Holy cow.
Right? I know.
I mean, in terms of budget.
Oh, well, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, honestly, well, this movie probably wasn't very profitable because it didn't make its money back. But
well, yeah.
Hopefully it did on DVD and Blu-ray. But yeah, we're looking, as I said, at a release on October 31st, 2008. A brief runtime of 82 minutes. Thank you, Lord. Mm-hmm. The opening weekend gross, I mean, again, y'all, four theaters, we're looking at the number 81 spot with about $9,500.
Yeah. It's just, how do you cut through that noise? Like, you're literally getting eyeballs of maybe a handful of people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what the plan was for this distribution model. Like, maybe if it did better, like, just for a four-theater release, like, it would have expanded. But again, like, if you weren't reading sites like Bloody Disgusting, I don't know if you were really aware this movie existed.
Yeah, I'll confess that I'm surprised it even went theatrical in four theaters at all, considering this seems like a very obvious play to capture the home video market.
100%. I mean, yeah, it was a different time back then. I don't know.
It's true. Yeah.
It does make, it goes on to make about 14,000 domestically and 500,000 overseas. So we're looking at a worldwide gross of $522,497.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So even given a $700,000 budget, if that's what it was, still didn't make its money back.
Well, and here's the thing, though, is if we truly believe that it was intended for home video, I'm willing to bet that it more than broke even, because this was the day and age where people were renting voraciously. So it probably made, like, I would wager anywhere between $8 and $20 million on home video.
I would wager that as well. I mean, if it at least made $1 million, like, there you go. Mm-hmm. It made its money back.
Yeah, I mean, whether the money gets back to the filmmaker is another question.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's something I won't even pretend to understand based on whatever distribution model we're looking at here.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do wonder what, I mean, because Toby Wilkins, so, you know, he, as you said, he does this, he does The Grudge 3, and then he really just sticks to TV a lot after this. I mean, these are the only two features he's done. He did a lot of Teen Wolf.
Okay. Interesting, considering the Jill Wagner connection.
Well, okay, so that's the thing. She is, for me, a dead ringer to Jennifer Esposito.
Mm, okay.
I don't know her from anything. So I saw, when I saw she was on Teen Wolf, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, Toby Wilkins did Teen Wolf. She's on Teen Wolf. Most of her career has been spent hosting the reality television show Wipeout.
Yep.
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah. And then she pops up in like Hallmark Christmas movies now too.
Oh, that's where you know. Well, that and Teen Wolf, I guess, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a wild career trajectory. It's one of those things where I could see people looking at her and being like, she's conventionally attractive. Like, she's exactly what you would expect to see on a Spike TV or something like that, right? But yeah. I have always found her very charismatic, and she seems kind of genuine.
Well, I mean, look, everyone, like, we're talking about the effects and stuff in this movie, but I actually think what elevates this movie above other, I'm going to say direct-to-video ilk, even though it did go to four screens, the character work in this film is above and beyond anything I would expect from this. And I'm not saying it's good just because it's better than I expected. It's legitimately good character work, and I love this central trio of protagonists that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will definitely co-sign on that. I think the other thing that surprises me is that the movie often zigs when you think it's going to zag. Like, this isn't a movie that just opens at the convenience store and stays at the convenience store because we could only afford one set. Like, you think that this is going to be a chase through the woods with something kind of deal. And instead, it then turns into this convenience store staged hostage thing. Like, the movie has a bunch of different subgenres at play. And I think that it's using them smartly in unconventional or maybe unexpected ways.
Well, I think the fact that we have an original creature at play makes it more interesting, because we're learning about this at the same time as the characters.
Right.
It's not like it's like, oh, it's a werewolf. Oh, it's a rabid dog. Like, no. This is something entirely new. And again, we're fitting all this into a very brief 82-minute runtime. So this movie flies by.
Yeah, and I like that we don't get all the answers. Like, we have no idea where it came from, how this first kind of rodent-y raccoon beaver thing got infected. Like, there's still questions that can be asked of this. Like, there's, frankly, sequel opportunities that I would gladly welcome here.
Oh, 100%.
But yeah, I mean, it benefits from the fact that it's a relatively simple and straightforward story, but the monster is really compelling, and the little glimpses we're getting into its anatomy, into its motivations, how it works, and all that kind of stuff, they're intriguing, but they're not overdone. Like, the movie isn't stopping to put the creature under a microscope.
Well, I guess I'm not really surprised that we didn't get a sequel to this, given the box office take, but at the same time, yeah, I would love to see more of this world, if only because we so rarely get to see original creatures anymore.
This is true, yeah, and ones that are well executed.
Well, yes, absolutely. Even going back to that budget, I'm just like, how did they do some of this stuff? And that's why the shaky cam doesn't really bother me as much, because as you said, the shots where we do get to see this creature, I say creature, it's if anyone's watching The Last of Us, it's basically a fungus or a mole that takes over your body and, like, you know, parasites itself onto you.
Right.
But there's something just so visually interesting about the splinter effects of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a quill kind of effect, right? And particularly when you think, oh, in these movies, it's very evocative of a zombie film or some other kind of pathogen, right? Where you cannot get too close to it because all you need is one piece of contact. Like, that's what happens to Dennis, right? He gets a finger pricked, and by the end of the movie, he's out.
Oh, Shea Whigham. How good. Because when I saw this movie, I didn't know who Shea Whigham was. And so watching this, I was like, oh, that's Shea Whigham!
Well, it's funny. I was actually, we took a brief moment so that you could check something, and I was like, how do I know Shea Whigham? And I went back through some of his filmography. He's done a bunch of TV. He often plays either a cop or a bad dude.
Yep.
So this is very much in his track record. But I realized that I know him from that season of Fargo. And he was also in the Agent Carter TV series.
And you are 100% correct. Like, honestly, because when I was pulling my little, like, you know, like my cheat sheet for this, I was like, I don't know what I know Shea Whigham from, but I've definitely seen that season of Fargo. I've definitely seen the season of True Detective that he's on.
Right.
Boardwalk Empire is a big thing, but he's also in Take Shelter, Silver Linings Playbook, Kong Skull Island, First Man, Vice, Joker. And I'm like, well, I've definitely seen at least half of those movies.
Yeah, he turns up in a couple of your Fast and Furious movies, too.
Yes, he does. My Fast and the Furious movies, as if you don't watch every single one of those things.
I deny. You can't prove anything.
But anyway, okay, so before I pass it off to you, Joe, critical reception, we are looking at a 76% on Rotten Tomatoes with an average score of 6.4 out of 10. And on Letterboxd, we've got a 6 out of 10. So, but again, I've been seeing more people come around to this, discover this and be like, oh, wow, that's really good. So if you haven't seen it yet, hopefully we will convince you to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's go.
Okay. So we open with a crane shot that brings us down to the eyeline on Sherman Gas Station. And we're following a chip-eating attendant who's credited, apparently, as Blake Sherman Jr., who, as you mentioned, is played by Charles Baker. But, like, this character has virtually no dialogue. I think he wears a name tag, which is maybe where people pulled this information from. But he's kind of our opening introduction kill, right? Like, he gets attacked by something that he sees next to the gas station. We don't really get to see it, but then we see the results of the attack, which are intercut with the credits.
Yeah, this is where you'll get, again, your first taste of that shaky cam. Also, if anyone's a big Breaking Bad fan, this actor is best known for playing Skinny Pete on Breaking Bad and El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, I definitely recognized him, but I was kind of just like, am I confusing him with some other sort of like generic faced white dude?
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, no, I mean, all we really get to see here, you know, we see the shuffle, and it's again, you're going to know right away if this style of editing is for you or not. But I will say it's not all throughout the film. It's just really in these major action scenes, which granted, there are quite a few of.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's one or two sort of sustained moments where you've got to deal with it, but a lot of the time, it's not as bad as you might expect.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I know that a lot of people, when they're watching movies like this, they're not taking budget into effect, but sometimes, like, this kind of style of camera work is meant to hide, not bad effects, because the effects in this movie aren't bad, but, like, maybe where you could see that it is just that, an effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's we're trying to be strategic with the way that we film and edit because we don't have the budget to just let you linger on something.
Yes, but that being said, if you have motion sickness, maybe not the best movie for you to watch.
You know what? Take a Dramamine and jump on in, people.
Exactly that.
Okay, so after, yes, Sherman Jr. goes down, we then move over to, I wrote SUV, it could be a truck, I don't drive. A vehicle with four tires that can carry multiple passengers is traveling down the road, and there is this ominous test site warning on the fence that they drive by. I didn't really capture it, but I was very much like, Zombiever.
Yeah. Oh my god. Talk about original creatures, by the way. I will say, so listen to the commentary. It's not like a particularly insightful commentary. It's a lot of like it's the director and the history cast members actually kind of hanging out, watching the movie together. So it's one of those like, oh, I feel like I'm in the room watching this with them, but you're not really getting a ton of insight. But right. I will say that Wilkins says that he believes that the creature has always been on Earth. It's been primordial, just kind of living under the ground or in the forest or whatever, and it's finally made its way out.
Okay, so this isn't some kind of government spill that has mutated a woodland creature.
That's not what he says, but honestly, I had the exact same thought you did when we're looking. I mean, again, whenever you see testing site signs, it's like, oh, red flag.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't have flashbacks to our experience watching The Outwaters earlier this month on Patreon, because we've had a similar discussion about, you know, like, oh, what do we think those sort of snaky, questionable things are? And that's a test site.
Yeah, but you know what? As you said, we're not going to learn anything about everything about this creature. The only thing we learn is because our main character, I'm sorry, one of our main characters, Seth, played by Paulo Costanzo, is...
He's a PhD in biology.
There you go. But he's working towards it. He doesn't have one yet, does he?
Right. No, okay. He's still a student because Dennis, the Shea Whigham character, actually dresses him down for it. Aren't you a bit old to be a student? How dare you, sir?
Have you ever been personally attacked by Regina George?
Have you ever been personally attacked by Dennis? Yeah, so Seth is one of the two passengers within this vehicle. The other one is Polly, played by Jill Wagner. They're celebrating their anniversary with plans to go hump under the stars. And Trace, I thought of you because you are such a Seth in that you would not go down for camping.
I would not be down for this. So yes, my husband's definitely more of a poly. He's not like, I wouldn't call him a camper, but he, now that we live in Colorado, he wants to do more camping.
Mm-hmm.
Me being the wonderful husband that I am, I am like, okay, I will be Seth and I will go and do this with you, but I'll probably break the tent just like Seth does.
Oh my god. I legitimately wondered if he was a Butterfingers, which I think is what we're meant to believe. I took it as, you know what? Fuck this tent. I don't want to do this. I'm just going to break a tent pole so that we can go spend the night in a motel.
Oh my god, that sounds awesome. Yes. The one thing, again, where the script subverts my expectations is, at most points in this movie, you think that we're going to get some kind of trivial conflict between the romance of this couple, right? And it never happens. I really, really appreciate that because we don't have time for that shit.
We don't, and we do, because I will confess, you know, I deliberately picked the queerest line of dialogue in the spirit of our sister podcast, Dirty Little Horror. You know, I picked out Dennis's line about the menage a trois because I thought it was a funny thing for a quote-unquote straight man character to say. But also, I think at the end of the day, Dennis and Polly have way better chemistry than Polly and Seth do. So I watched this movie and I'm like, in another version of this movie, Seth is killed when he makes his cold run to the sheriff's car and Dennis and Polly end up together.
Oh, I really do like Seth, though, like quite a bit. But it's interesting because I think when you first see them, you think that we're going to fall into that CBS sitcom trope of smoking hot wife with the kind of like schlubby husband.
I literally thought that. I was like, and he's a scientist. So it's basically the Big Bang Theory, a horror convenience store version.
But I don't think they don't have chemistry. I do agree that she has more chemistry than Shea Whigham, but that's also because he's the bad boy.
Yeah, I mean, like when Seth and Polly are kind of getting hot and heavy against the vehicle here, they definitely both look into it. They're selling this romance. It's just that, yeah, when, you know, Shea Whigham enters in, I don't know if it's that I think he's also just a better actor than Costanzo. Like, I've seen him in 40 Days and 40 Nights and Road Trip. I've never seen Royal Pain, so I couldn't comment on his acting there.
My parents worshipped at the altar of Royal Pain.
Dad, that show. I love it. It's basically hot doctor fucks his way through, but not gross hot doctor like Nip Tuck. That's basically what that show was.
Yes, exactly. Although he was on Upload season 2. I think he was the like the cult leader out in the woods.
Okay. Yes, that sounds about right.
But I actually know him best playing Alexander Cabot in the Josie and the Pussycats movie.
Oh, yes. Okay.
But, like, he doesn't have anything to do because Alexandra Missy Pyle is, like, the star of that movie.
Why are you even here? Because I was in the comic book.
Jesus Christ, that girl's got a skunk on her head.
That was a side plug for Josie and the Pussycats, a fucking amazing movie. I covered it on my YA podcast if you want to hear me gush about it.
It's so good. But anyway, I like Seth. I don't think that Katzen is a bad actor, but I mean, again,
he's fine.
When you're up against Shea Whigham with that particular character, yes, you're probably going to pale in comparison just a little bit.
Yeah. And you know what? You really nailed it when you said, oh, he's got that bad boy vibe to him, because Seth is kind of the... He's that boyfriend that you get when you realize you don't want bad boys anymore because he's safe. He's going to agree to go along and do things even though he doesn't want to. And the worst, most offensive thing he's going to do is talk to you about trees.
Well, but and let's okay. I think another thing contributing to this, though, is that Seth doesn't really have an arc in this movie. Whereas Dennis does. And the more we learn about Dennis, the more interesting he becomes as a character. And yes, I mean, you could maybe quibble with the fact that, he's a convict. Oh, but he's a convict. Like with a heart of gold. But again, it
could be cliche, but it's not.
Exactly. And so Seth doesn't have anything. And granted, neither really does Polly. It's true. Because she has that chemistry with Dennis, it kind of supersedes that.
Yeah, I think maybe this is just a personal preference, but I also find Jill Wagner is doing more. Like, she's more interesting to watch, even though I realize as the film progresses, Polly is the one who actually gets the least to do. Like, she doesn't get a martyr moment. She doesn't make a run for the car. Like, she honestly kind of fades into the background as the film progresses. And yet, I think by virtue of Wagner's charisma, which mm-hmm. I've mentioned now twice, I'm just going to keep saying it, I think she's a really dynamic performer and she keeps the character in the center of the action, even though she's not getting to do much.
Well, and she's never a damsel in distress either. Like, that's, I really appreciate that. But I do agree. Yes, you walk out of this movie remembering Wiggum and Wagner more than mm-hmm. you do Costanzo, even though Costanzo arguably has more to do in this film than Wagner does.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. So yes, I agree on all of that. It doesn't really hurt the movie for me, though.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's a bad thing. It was just something I noticed more on this rewatch.
Right.
And it's also, I think, surprising because it's not exactly what you would expect. Also, you think that we have a foursome because there's a fourth person in the mix, which is Lacey, played by Rachel Kerbs. And I did not remember her packing it in quite so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they ever really say, is it crack or meth that she's on?
I think they say meth.
Okay, it's meth. Yeah, that may. Oh, yeah, because I think Dennis says he was on like a 5-day high of meth when he killed mm-hmm. that person.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in this movie for a little bit. And again, you honestly think that she's going to be the nicer of the two, which she kind of is. But again,
kind of.
Once, yeah, she's also coming down off a high. I can't even imagine, I mean, coming off of a meth high during... Mm-hmm. During this scenario?
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it's bad enough when... Okay, so basically what ends up happening yeah. is we learn very quickly that Dennis and Lacey are criminals who are on the run, but their vehicle has broken down, so they ditch it in the woods, and then they pretend to be hitchhikers. We do the old thing, right, where it's, we'll let the girl go out and blag down a vehicle, and then the guy comes out, and the whole situation changes.
Oh, yeah. I love how they're like, Seth is going to drive the car, you're going to get in the back seat, and he's like, I can't drive a stick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this weird kind of emasculation vibe that's going on in especially the first act of this film, where it's like, oh, Seth, typically, he should be the one that has to save the day or be relied upon to be the hero. And instead, it keeps having to be Polly because she's the one who drives the car. It's her vehicle. So she knows where the spare tire is. She knows how to change it. He doesn't know any of this because, you know, he's a science guy.
Well, then I guess I'll correct what I said earlier. Then I guess that is Seth's arc, right? Like, he is the emasculated nerdy man who has mm-hmm. to prove himself for being masculine, which is maybe also why you and I are gravitating towards that arc less, because it's inherently less interesting to us.
Right. Yeah, that's entirely possible. I'd be curious to know if we have like straight male listeners who watch this and were kind of like, oh, yeah, this is my trope. This is the kind of thing that I see all the time in quote-unquote conventional action films.
Yeah, and not that I think Seth is an incel by any means, but like the term incel
wow,
didn't really...
that took a hard turn.
No, because the term incel wasn't really like a common vernacular back then. Mm-mm. But I feel like the arc, not the arc, but like the type of character Seth is would be more incel-y if it was being made today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe I'm off base there.
Incel adjacent, let's say.
Yeah, sure.
So anyway, Dennis and Lacey commandeer this vehicle, and we are back on the road. They are looking to make a break to Mexico. It's what Dennis has promised Lacey. They just have to make a pit stop in a place called Platt so that they can collect some financials. And they're basically going to make these kids take them on a road trip. It's a little like Dust Till Dawn-y.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's a really, really good comparison. Except we never really get more people in this movie. It's pretty much just the four of them for the entire time.
This is true. And I love that almost immediately this vehicle breaks down because we have run over an animal, which is either the same one from the opening or maybe another infected one. But we get a flat almost immediately and we pull over to the side of the road and split into two different groups. So Lacey decides that she needs to check on the animal because, I mean, as you said, she's coming down off of a high. She's clearly not fully in control of her faculties. She mistakes whatever this fucking thing was for, I want to say it's her dead dog. What do you think? Who is Goldie?
I guess that's what it is. Or honestly, maybe it was her pet raccoon from back in the day on the farm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But Nevertheless, this is basically a flattened carcass.
Yeah. I said Goldie. It's not Goldie. It's Ginger, according to my notes. But
Ginger the raccoon.
This thing is the definition of roadkill. Like, you can't even identify what this is. This is just the props took some blood and viscera and splashed it across pavement. And this actress is, like, go into town with the waterworks. She's so upset.
Just holding this poor man at gunpoint, like, you're a doctor, fix it.
Mm-hmm. This is one of my nightmare scenarios where you basically get caught with somebody who is not in their right mind and they're just making demands of you and you have no idea how they're going to react to anything that you do. I find that terrifying.
I mean, are you in any type of scenario stopping to pick up a hitchhiker?
No, but mostly because it's, I would say mostly because I've seen so many horror films.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I get it. You know, there's a thing where it's like, you can be like, oh, I want to be a good person and help someone out. But the problem is, especially in today's world, you don't know. I mean, self-preservation comes first, unfortunately. And so it's like, again, what if something like this happens? And then the person who you're picking up, their partner comes out and puts a gun to your head.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's aggressive, right? Like the way that Dennis takes control of this car, he's got Polly laid out on the pavement at gunpoint.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelming. And when we then, you know, have this sort of first of multiple car incidents, let's say, you know, Polly is left with this guy. And there's very much a... I'm going to suggest that these two actors have chemistry together, but in this early scene, it's a vaguely threatening sexual chemistry where you wonder, is Dennis going to try to do something to Polly?
Oh, I'm really glad the movie does not go into that territory because
no,
this movie
it doesn't
need it.
It doesn't. If anything, you could argue that Seth is more vulnerable because Lacey is the one with the gun and she's a little more unhinged.
But again, she means well, but yeah, she's, you know, I don't really know exactly what happens in a meth come down, but apparently it's not good.
Yeah. In this case, she definitely flips out when this creature begins to reconstitute and it kind of moves and she shoots it. And then we're all back in the car. Unfortunately, even though we have changed the spare tire, the radiator goes almost immediately, but we can cruise to a very convenient, very familiar-looking gas station, Trace.
And so this is when, because Dennis gets pricked on his thumb here because he, like, gets too close to it. Again, minor bit of CGI. It's whenever he pulls it out of his thumb.
Out of his thumb? Oh.
That's what CGI. And again, whenever CGI is used in this film, with the exception of two shots, it's always to enhance the practical effects. It's mixed in with the practical effects. It's never just CGI. And it's always like, oh, like we need another splinter or two in this mass of practical splinters. Let's CGI some splinters in.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's fascinating because I feel like if we gave this movie a bigger budget and made it today, the entire creature would be CGI nonsense. Folks, if you want to hear us talk about a really, really bad example of that, stay tuned to the Patreon next month.
Also, 3 years after this, we get that pre-make of The Thing.
Right. Which, you know, that's a very distinctive example where we should have trusted the practical effects and instead we just super augmented them with CGI and it comes out like dog shit.
Yeah, and I think I bring it up only because I think like The Thing has a lot in common. I'm sorry, I think this movie has a lot in common with The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think The Thing pre-make is fine. Like, it's basically a remake that's just, you're told it takes place 2 weeks before the first movie. But like, again, if you were disappointed by the CGI in that film, I give you Splinter.
mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah, the lo-fi version.
Yeah.
Okay, so we creep into this gas station and Lacey immediately says she has to go to the bathroom. So she tries to go. She cannot open the door. And meanwhile, the others, you know, Dennis is definitely taking charge. He's like, okay, Polly, you and I, we're going to go in. We're going to get coolant for this radiator. Seth, you're going to stay in the car, but I'm taking the keys. And it seems like we're kind of in generic hostage crime film mode. And then Lacey manages to open the door and we see what is left of Carl Jr. And he is looking more hamburger than human being at this point. And this is our first sort of glimpse of what it looks like when you go full Splinter.
Oh, I was going to say, are we just going to keep calling it the creature? Let's just call it Splinter.
Sure. Yeah.
But I love Lacey's reaction. She runs out and she's like, there's a man with spikes.
I mean, I feel like I wouldn't have the language to describe what I had just seen because this is so weird and unique, right? And of course, because it's the character who's coming down,
yeah,
everybody just disbelieves her.
Yeah. Which, fair. I mean
honestly, you would.
When talking about horror movie characters that make bad decisions, I actually think that, I mean, again, y'all can maybe argue, but I think that everyone here does the best, makes the best decisions they possibly can in this ridiculous situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one point where two of the characters try to do something and the other one stops them. And it's like, no, we're not doing that because we're in a gas station. We don't need to play with fire right now.
But we never get the whole, like, don't you watch horror movies? Don't do that. And then, no, mm-hmm. this is not that kind of movie.
Right, yeah, they're not making stupid decisions so that the movie can then move forward in that capacity.
And then also not calling out the fact that, you know, horror movie characters make bad decisions, so they shouldn't make them either. It's not a meta movie.
No, not meta at all, thank God. Yeah. I could see a version of this, but I also don't want that.
No. This to me feels, I mean, again, despite the fact that it's 2008, it feels very old school with its approach to this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you compared this to The Thing, and I think you could easily look at this. This movie does have a bit of a 90s flair to me, which is maybe the other reason why I thought I saw it in the early 2000s. But, like, this does, yeah, you're right, have that old school kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
So, we neglected to mention that Splinter, or Splinter in his current form in the bathroom, is still alive, so he begs Lacey to kill him. She comes and says, you know, like, hey, I saw this thing, and it's almost immediate, right? Like, she is just killed by this thing when it barrels out of the bathroom right in front of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
It happens so quickly. Like, yeah, once again, we've got the shaky cam, we've got the very fast-paced editing, but it's like Lacey is down and bleeding, and the movie kicks into high gear.
Yeah. It does not. I mean, we have an hour left, so yeah, we got to go.
Okay, so they end up locking themselves in the gas station, and we get this kind of beat where everybody gets to collect their breaths, but also we're still looking at Lacey's body because she is, what, 4 or 5 feet away over at the gas pumps. And it's like, this is the rest of the movie, folks. We're going to spend it in this very tight, constrained area. We're going to find new places to discover and hide. But for the most part, it's like, this is now the movie, just inside this gas station.
And I think, too, this is the only real time in the movie where we are one step ahead of the characters because we have seen the opening prologue to this film. So much of the next, like, 5 minutes of the screen time is spent with Dennis being like, she's alive, she's alive, even though she's clearly dead and the thing is just moving for her.
Yeah, and I do love that Polly immediately clocks that. Like, we neglected to mention that Dennis does shoot Splinter, so the gas station attendant is now sprawled over the hood of their car. Ugh. But yeah, Dennis goes to look at the security cam footage, which will also come into play later in the film, and he sees that one of Lacey's arms is moving, and I love the herky jerkiness of it because it looks like she's being marionetted, right? Which is exactly what this creature is doing. But, you know, Dennis is grief-stricken. This is the woman that he loves, and just because he's a villain doesn't mean that he didn't have affection for her. So he wants to go out, and Polly's just like, dude, look at her. She is dead.
Well, and honestly, it's the information we learn about Dennis as the film goes on, you know? I mean, like, I'm jumping ahead here, obviously, but it's like, they were both on meth together. He got clean. She did not. He murdered someone. He's gonna go to Mexico and get her clean, but after they give money to these people that he killed, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, they have been through so much, and I can't even imagine, too, being, like, that close to freedom.
Right.
And then having this happen to you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they had a plan, and maybe one of the things he thought would happen was that, yeah, he would have to take someone hostage because their car breaks down, or, like, you know, you might have to do something quote-unquote bad. I don't think he thought that he was going to be in a gas station standoff with some kind of otherworldly creature.
Or have Lacey die, period. I don't think that was even in his bingo bucket list at all for that year.
Yeah. Yeah. But she is, in fact, dead. But yeah, he wants to check on her. He wants to bring the body inside. So we get this great tension-filled moment because, as you said, we as an audience 100% know what's going on. Like, there's no suspect that she is still alive. We know that he's about to get, well, we're already pretty sure he's been infected based on the finger prick. But he's proposing to bring an infected thing into their sanctuary, into their safe space. But I love how just generous with the time we are with this sequence, right? Where he's crouched down. We're having debates about whether or not to lock the door. How many bullets does he have?
Oh,
but
yeah,
we're holding on him as he's like inching towards her and making to grab her arm. And you're just like, you're waiting for the shoe to drop.
And that's what I mean. Like, I don't think this is a particularly scary movie, but it's very effectively tense.
It's tense.
Also, but it's also very fun. Like, it's a perfect balance between those two things.
Yeah. Like, I was watching this by myself, and I definitely wish that I had a gaggle of gays and a bunch of booze so that we can just, you know, like this is a great movie, I think, even for the horror squeamish, because it's just the right amount of scare slash tenseness that you're going to get somebody who goes like, no, I can't watch.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Like, I wasn't like covering my eyes during this movie, but so I went, oh, several times.
Yeah.
And it's not really the gore. It's more so like it is body related things, but it's not like blood and guts. It's bone snapping and hyperextension.
Ooh, yeah. I do love the bone stuff. Okay. So we do end up sort of starting to grab her. But then I think Dennis very quickly realizes that whatever has happened to Lacey, he is not safe. So he tries to make a break to get back inside. But one of her, this sort of animated hand, latches onto him. They pull him inside and they sever the arm in the door.
Oh, I love that. So many limbs of Splinter just flying off in this movie.
Yeah, and this hand is fully thinking about, like, it is moving, it is reacting to them, and I think that the hands, like, the hands and the arms look really good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the hand we get that kind of, like, takes up the third act of this film is completely puppeteered. It's all being pulled on strings, and again, the shaky cam works because we are getting pretty long shots of this hand moving across the floor, but we're shaking the camera to kind of hide the natural, like, pulling motion of it with the strings of the puppeteer. So again, in those scenarios, I'm like, I can see what's happening. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm so invested in it. Like, I'm fully into the film, so I'm not even thinking about it. Like, I'm not concerned with how they're doing it because I think it looks solid enough that I'm not taken out of the film, like, noticing strings, noticing bad CGI. I'm just in it with the characters.
100%.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, yeah, we realize that this thing is moving. It's reacting to them. So we're not safe. And that's before Lacey gets up and begins throwing herself at the door repeatedly.
This is violent and rough.
And it goes on. I thought, okay, she's going to do it for a couple of moments and then we're going to retreat to the back of the store and it'll be over. This goes on for, I want to say, 2 minutes.
It's a while. Also, I think by this point, the actress playing Lacey is out of the film. So this is when our gymnast is stepping in with the practical effects makeup with Lacey's face on him.
Yeah, I feel like you can see it because the body is definitely getting more mutilated every time she headbutts this glass door. But again, it's a misdirect thing where I'm watching the blood splatter on the window, like on the glass, because it's just getting bigger. But you can see that the face is getting increasingly mutilated. And yeah, like, it's not that actress anymore.
Yeah. But it's fine because she
doesn't matter. No.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's not uncanny because she doesn't look like a human, but it's a thing where she's like this mold of a creature that has a semblance of her face on it, but it's not her.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So another cue that Dennis is not the hard-boiled criminal that we expect. He's actually tearing up. Like, he is visibly emotionally distraught by seeing his now dead ex reanimated in this way. He doesn't even move until Seth pulls him into this back supply room. And then we notice, okay, there's a door. So let's get through this door. Let's get to safety. Let's make a break for it. Only problem is, Trace, it's locked.
Yeah, so there is only one way. It's so they found this gas station, and it was a concrete block that they found because they wanted something in the middle of nowhere that was actually surrounded by forest. So this is an actual like concrete block of a place in Oklahoma City, and a good chunk of the budget, while going to practical effects, was also completely remodeling this concrete block of a building to make it all glass from the front, so you can like have that perfect view of the outside. They're just locked inside. They can't go anywhere. And this is when we start to learn a little bit about the creature, too, because this is when Seth's expertise comes in, and he's like, oh, it's metabolizing the blood. The black goo is its waste. And I was like, oh, that's ew.
Gross. And yet highly efficient, right? Like, as I joked earlier, it's not like we're putting this thing under a microscope. And it's important, though, that we still understand a little bit of its physiology, because we have to understand A, how we're going to fight it, and B, how it works. So, like, what does the infection do? That kind of stuff. But I like that, you know, yeah, we just say Seth knows biology, and he's able to make some relatively simple deductions. Like, he doesn't get it entirely right. It's not like he's an expert on this monster simply by observing it for 30 seconds.
Right.
He comes to rational decisions that are informed by visual evidence, and then they act accordingly until they learn otherwise.
Yep.
Which I appreciate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Although I would love to see a movie like this, though, where, like, there's not a scientist. And they're just made. Because, again, what we learn about the creature informs the decisions the characters will make as the film goes on.
True.
What I would love to see in a movie like this is someone, like the group, they're like, oh, this is what it does. And they're totally fucking wrong.
Oh, no, we just lost AJ. Oh, yeah. Sorry, AJ.
And they just make a decision that gets, like, half of their team killed.
I mean, I think I've said it a couple times, but I always go back to It Follows, the end, where they're like, we think it's going to do this. And you're just like, why did you think that? You had no proof of it. And you're just like, oh, it's because the characters are dumb. They were trying to do the best they could, but they had no idea what they were up against.
That's actually an excellent example, and I'm so glad you brought it up. And I don't mind that, but as we discussed in that episode on that film, some people had a big issue with that being the climax of the film.
Yeah.
When, again, the answer is, well, they're just stupid kids. Like, they're not doctors or scientists.
Yeah, and the reality is, you know, in every group, there is not a scientist or, like, a medical practitioner. Horror films love to give us, you know, oh, well, there will be a cop in there, somebody will have a gun, somebody's going to be a nurse or something like this. Not always. Like, when I'm out with my friends, I'm not looking around and realizing, oh, well, if a zombie apocalypse happened right now, we'd be okay. It's like, no, I got a bunch of office worker friends and we're fucked.
It's just screenplay 101, because movies love to give exposition, because audiences don't like to be left in the dark about certain aspects of the plot, especially when it comes to something that is supernatural or otherworldly. And while I think this movie gives us a decent balance of the two, where we learn some things, but not everything.
Yeah, yeah. And what we learn is the kind of thing where if we didn't have a Seth, it would be harder to get around, but it's not so much that it feels like an exposition dump.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we go looking for the keys. We can't find them. So that means that they're probably on the dude who's hanging out on the hood of the car outside. It's not safe there. So Dennis, ever the practical criminal, says, let's pop the hinges off this door. So we use a screwdriver. That's Seth and Polly doing all the work here. And we open it up. Lo and behold, there's another door that they can't get through.
A set of bars on the door. And I want to be like, I mean, I guess I get it, because you want to protect yourself from theft and whatever. And like, you know, whatever. But this is the middle of, maybe that's why. They're in the middle of nowhere.
It's the middle of nowhere. It's also the middle of the night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically, for now, we are fucked. But the good thing is that someone has arrived, Trace. So we introduce the only other character that will appear in this film, Sheriff Frankel, who is played by Laurel Whitsett. And she is there because she knows that Dennis is in there, and she thinks that this is a hostage situation, which technically she is, right?
Yeah.
But also they're just like, get in your fucking car, you're not safe. And she's like, it's okay, civilians.
I actually love the way this is shot, because every mm-hmm. time we're always seeing it from the people who are listening's side of the glass.
Right.
So when they're talking, we're out there with the cops. So we're kind of hearing their muffled versions. It's like, we can hear what they're saying, and we know what they're saying because we know mm-hmm. what they're going through. But yep. also, like, I think it does a good job of not making this cop seem so incredibly incompetent.
Yeah, like, she sees a bunch of frantic people who are kind of yelling over top of each other, and she's like, don't worry, I'm here, I'm gonna take control of the situation. No, I'm not gonna get in my car because you're in there yeah. with a convicted criminal. Like, yeah. I'm here to protect you, that's my job. And they, meanwhile, are like, no, we're actually fine. There's something far worse outside, and you're not listening to us right now.
The convict is fine, we promise. Please go to your car.
Right? Which, I love this scenario, because what authority figure, what, you know, member of the police force would say, oh, sure, yeah, I'll get in my car while you're still in there. Like, no, this is exactly how it would play out. It's just that we are in a creature feature.
Yep. 100%. So again, I buy all of this. This is, it's just like the Murphy's Law worst case scenario of what could be happening right now. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, in a horror movie, whenever a cop shows up, I mean,
yeah,
they're either a bad guy or they're not long for this world.
Right. Or they're the central protagonist or something.
Yeah.
Sheriff Frankel is none of those things. So this is very similar to what happened to Lacey, where the violence is so abrupt and fast. Like, 1 minute, Sheriff Frankel is there. The next, she's dangling in the air. We're seeing blood coming down. And then this motherfucker gets ripped in half.
Yes. And this is the only use of green screen in the movie, when we are ripping this body in half, by the way.
Yeah.
This, I think the close-up shots of her waist splitting mm-hmm. are fantastic.
Yep.
My favorite part, again, it's just a little comedy that's put in here, but it's Seth's reaction, just going, it took half of her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I love, you know, we've said this movie isn't, have we said it? I don't know. I would say that this film isn't, like, egregiously showy in its kind of directorial flourishes, mm-hmm. but I do love the decision to just, like, we're going to crane the camera up, we're going to follow this blood pattern, and
oh, yeah.
we're going to go up onto the roof to see what's happening as the body kind of reconstitutes itself together with something yeah. else.
So yeah, of course, fun, like, a regular trick of horror or film in general, we are shooting this in reverse, which is why mm-hmm. why it looks so cool when it's coming back together. And again, a little bit of CGI where we're adding CGI splinters, like, in spots, but again, okay. we still have practical splinters. They're just adding things to, like, fill gaps, basically.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is also being shot in the dark, so, like, there's a certain amount of, you know, you can't see because you're peering at the screen, but overall, this looks great. I love it when things are shot in reverse like this, because, I don't know, it always gets me. It works for me so well.
It's because it reminds you of Hellraiser.
Maybe. I'm not that predictable. Yes, that's exactly it. Okay, so we do get a quick kind of update for our benefit about how Dennis's finger is looking, and it's now not just the tip, it's the whole digit.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But doesn't his thumb bend backwards at this point?
I think we still have a little bit further to go, but yeah, he's definitely infected. He's definitely looking worse. He's doing that thing where he doesn't tell anybody what's happening. That's fine for now.
Yeah.
We get a little bit of clever dialogue foreshadowing where he calls Polly a firecracker because she says that she wants to run.
And to which she replies, I'm nothing like your white trash drugged out girlfriend. And then he just goes, yep, firecracker.
It's like, okay, well, you're proving my point. This is really where the banter is starting to come in between these two characters. Seth is in kind of scientist investigation mode, and these two are just kind of like... I made a joke that there's another version of this film where the two of them end up together. There's a whole other subgenre of film where this is a romantic comedy and these two are just like, they're bickering because they're perfect.
Okay, no, my favorite dialogue exchange is actually between Polly and Seth, and she's like, Seth, we don't know shit, Seth. We know it attacks you and you die. And then he goes off on this like minute-long monologue about like science and fungus and mold and bullshit. And she's like, so you're saying it attacks you and you die.
I'm telling you, Wagner is selling all of these lines. That's why she's so great.
It's so good. But again, like, there's never, like, a conflict driven between them that's like, oh, like, they're, like, breaking up or something. It's just, it's normal humans interacting and reacting to a shitty scenario.
For sure. And they're not being shitty to each other.
Yes, yes. There's no pettiness in this film, which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, we will never see Dennis actively working against them except for him not revealing that he's been infected. But he's not, you know, bossing them around. He's not being that kind of, like, shitty crime character who doesn't trust them, doesn't want to believe them. Like, all of that was left behind the minute the creature attacked.
And here's the thing, too. With him not telling them, like, that's a standard zombie movie trope, right? Mm-hmm. It bothers me more in zombie movies because most people in zombie films, especially modern ones, know what a fucking zombie is. And it's like, right. Dude, like, what the fuck? With this, A, it doesn't lead into him infecting someone else by accident. So there's immediate forgiving right there.
Thank God.
Also, I do believe that's like, we don't know for sure 100% what this does. And so I think he's still in denial, which makes sense. I buy denial less in a zombie film.
Yeah, like he knows that something is wrong, but he isn't exhibiting any kind of unusual behavior, right? Like he hasn't changed as a person. He's not acting like Lacey did. So I think he's just kind of, all right, well, we will revisit the situation accordingly as time goes on.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Seth, ever the rational, says, well, okay, so the sheriff is dead, but now that she's come, someone else will come. And this is kind of the only plot point that I don't think entirely gels in this movie. Dennis assures him that they're looking in the wrong place for him because they're going to be looking north, whereas they're headed south. And I'm like, yeah, but they also know exactly where this sheriff went to. Like, they would be able to track her, hypothetically.
Well, could they?
I don't know. Like, it was a note that kind of briefly rang false to me, but then the movie moves by it and there's interesting things happening. I don't think it's anything more than a hiccup, but I was just like, that doesn't seem entirely right.
Well, because she calls it in on her, the cop calls it in her walkie-talkie, but they keep saying though, like we're assuming that someone on the other end heard her call it in because no one replied to her.
Yeah.
But yeah, do they have like trackers on cop cars in 2008? Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe Oklahoma didn't have that. I don't know.
Budget cuts. It was a rough time.
But no, yeah, I feel you there. You could also argue, well, he's saying that, but you could also argue that the time span of the film is so short and they're so far in the middle of nowhere that there wasn't enough time for cops to get there by this point. I don't know.
Sure. Either that or they're like, we don't know how much longer we're going to be able to survive in this fucking place. We can't afford to wait, even if they are on their way.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, honestly, valid point.
So Polly and Dennis's strategy is that they are going to basically start a fire using lighter fluid because they've got a bunch of it in this convenience store. That is one of the other fun things about this movie is that it's one of those like magical locations where various items that you would need to fight to survive and so on, they're at your fingertips. And this movie does a good job of saying like, yeah, we've got lighter fluid, we've got coat hangers, we've got keys, we've got food and all this other stuff. Like, I think it's a really smart location to set a horror film in.
I agree, but also I'm just kind of like, okay, y'all are set for a while. You have plenty of food. There's drinks in there. You've got a shitter. Oh, wait, no, the shitter's outside. So you're going to be pooping inside.
Yeah. Poop in a bucket. Floor. You're fine.
Just go into the freezer. That can be your toilet.
Yeah. I don't know if we need a little bit more urgency of like, this thing is going to bust in and we can't afford to stay here because we don't have that.
Right.
But I guess I do understand the urgency of feeling like, we're so isolated, we don't know when someone could hypothetically come by. We need to get out of here ourselves.
Well, and I think too, because I mean, again, like, yeah, they're locked in safe for the moment. But I mean, we keep seeing Lacey bash her body against that thing. It's climbing up on the roof. Like, they don't know for a fact this place is 100% secure.
Right. Do you think this would work a smidge better if we started to see the glass cracking as Lacey was beating?
Ooh. yes. And because you could do that, the car windshield effect where you smash a windshield, but it doesn't shatter, but like, mm-hmm. it cracks the spider whole webs. Fucking thing. Yeah, yes, all that shit. Ooh, yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
Okay. I mean, again, budget, because
yeah.
A pane of glass is not cheap to replace if you need to shoot this a couple times.
Yeah, minor quibble, not a big issue. But it goes back to, oh my God, what is it? The Lost World Jurassic Park, right? With the trailer scene.
Right, yes. Not where I thought you were going with this, but mm-hmm.
I still know what you did last summer. Brandy on the greenhouse roof.
There we, you know what? I like it better. Okay, so yeah, Molly and Dennis want to basically start a fire, and Seth says, no, look at where we're, look where we are.
I'm sorry, forest critters. I will start forest fires to escape a splinter monster in a gas station.
I don't even think that he cared that much about that. He just didn't like the idea of the fire coming back to them, which to me is immediately where my mind went.
I guess so, but, you know, go in the freezer. I think the freezer will freeze any fire that makes its way in.
Okay. Folks, if you are ever in a survival situation and Dr. Trace is your scientist, you're all going to fucking die.
Yeah, no, I am 100% the kids from It Follows.
Okay, so Seth proposes an alternative, which is that they use a variety of wire hangers and duct tape fashioned into a kind of hook so that they can grab said walkie-talkie, and that doesn't require them to open a door or start a fire. So this is what they do. This is where Dennis's thumb breaks itself, and it is fucking good.
It is real good. And this is when he decides to, oh wait, no, because he's like, oh, I just cut myself.
Mm-hmm. He just wraps it in a t-shirt.
This is fine. What is that? That meme of that dog surrounded by a house of fire. He's like, this is fine.
This is fine. It's just my thumb. How often do I use a thumb?
I just lost my girlfriend. A thumb's no big deal.
This is so true. Yeah. So, I do love this jump scare when the sheriff's hand snakes in under this kind of plexiglass. Like, I'm assuming this is like if people wanted to walk by and pay for something, but you didn't want to open up, you would use this kind of tray.
Yeah. So in my days of smoking cigarettes, frequently after hours, or at least like once it gets dark, a lot of gas stations will like close down.
Okay.
But you can buy cigarettes through that little through that window. And it's almost like a bank teller place, but it's for cigarettes.
That's hilarious, because I've definitely seen the gas station across from my house do that, and I never really understood, because I'll just see a weird lineup of like four or five people in the middle of the night sometimes.
Oh yeah, they're getting cigarettes.
So lo and behold, this arm snakes in this tray, and they end up hacking it off with a pipe, Polly does, and now all of a sudden we've got this arm on the floor coming after them.
I love these kind of suspense set pieces, because they're using the wire hanger to get the cops walkie-talkie. It's almost there, but then, of course, it's like, you know it's coming. You know it's going to happen, but it's so effective. Who cares if I predicted it?
Well, ironically enough, I'll confess, I didn't predict it. I thought that we were going to rip the cord on the walkie-talkie, because it is stretched so taut.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you knew it wasn't going to work one way or another.
I like the plan, but it seemed logistically it was going to have some flaws. Yeah.
Well, then where it goes is actually much better than the cord ripping, because, yeah, now we have one of these things in there with them.
Mm-hmm. So they realize that Dennis has kind of disappeared, and this thing is attacking them. They have to use a kind of dryer rack to prevent it from getting to them.
I love this.
This is when we realize Dennis has disappeared into the freezer. So that's where we go next.
Yes. But I mean, honestly, these shots, I mean, again, they're these shaky cam shots, but it's just Seth holding up this great thing as this thing is like, and it's also immediately dangerous because it's a great. So this thing can still stick him. So while we're having this whole issue of like trying to escape Splinter, we still have the conscious idea of like, oh shit, like we can't touch this thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. And they don't know that. Like, they know that it's feasting on flesh, but they don't know how easy, like, how transmittable the splinters are. Mm-hmm. So they should actually be more worried than they are. They think that they just have to keep it away and they're doing just fine. But lo and behold, they get into the freezer and they're okay. And this is where we get a little bit more information that it seems to be able to track them, but it's not thinking. It's just instinctual.
Yes, which we will learn more about soon.
Uh-huh. So this is when we realize that Dennis is definitely infected because his arm breaks at this point.
The snapping.
Mm-hmm.
Good sound design in this film, by the way. This is, I mean, like, we get a full shot of this. It is just this arm bending backwards. And I think stuff like this is much more, like, viscerally upsetting to me than any kind of, like, disembowelment.
Oh, that's interesting. Part of me is like, let's do a poll. Let's see what people think. But yeah, like, this reminds me of the cave sequence from Old, which was one of my favorite deaths of the year. Yeah, I find bones breaking very disturbing, but particularly when it is this kind of like herky jerky and then the Foley work is great. Like, the sequence is so effective for me.
I think it's because having an arm bend too far backwards, a hyperextension, mm-hmm. is infinitely more relatable and possible to right. your average human than being, you know, gutted.
Mm. Right. Yeah, that is fair.
And it's just like, blah, 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 blah. This is fantastic. I love all of this. And it looks really good.
Yeah. And particularly when, yeah, I said that we're in a convenience store, so we've got a lot of amenities at our disposal. But, you know, when he realizes the arm needs to come off, we don't have an axe. We don't have a giant serrated blade like a kitchen knife or something. So he passes out from the pain of this broken arm. And they go to town with an X-Acto knife. It is like the ruins level of all barf.
Yes. And here, and it's not quite as graphic as the ruins, but honestly, again, you're really on point with your comparisons tonight. Also, this would have been the same year as the ruins, actually. It would have been like four months later.
Body horror for the win in 2008.
But we get a close-up shot of this knife going into his arm flesh. And as if that wasn't bad enough. So this is when Polly's like, it's okay, we're cutting off your arm.
Yeah.
But they then have to, like, put his arm over, like, a metal bar and then use a concrete block.
But here's the thing. I would say this movie isn't particularly funny. Like, there's a couple of lines of dialogue, which you have mentioned, that are pretty amusing.
Yes.
This visual image of them being like, I can't get through the bone, snap cut to them, like, hoisting this giant concrete block over his arm.
Well, it's it's not funny. Even her saying like it's okay, we're cutting your arm off. Like, it's, I think all of them are in shock. So even though it like sounds silly, like when you hear it, it's also kind of like, but this is fucked up. Oh. And I don't even know what I would be doing at this point in time.
And they are reacting so quickly. Like, they're actually managing to really keep their cool, their calm, their collection over all of this.
Yeah.
But we are moving at the speed of light with all of these decision makings. You know, oh, the arm is broken, the arm has to come off, we're cutting, we're concrete slabbing.
Yeah. Oh, and I will say, though, he has a lot of luck with that concrete block because he just brings it down once and that arm just falls right off.
It's the ultimate one and done. Yeah. I mean, the fact that Dennis ever recovers from this, like the fact that Dennis can be a productive member of this film for the rest of the runtime is, it's maybe the biggest logic jump of the film.
And smartly, too, this is when we get a bit of a breather from all the action because we get more character development here.
Yeah.
And even something as silly as, like, you know, when Dennis is like, oh, you fuck if you can't chop an arm off. And then Polly's like, yeah, he's a keeper.
Oh, man. Yeah, we're drinking. We're sitting around. This is where Dennis's backstory comes out. And I think this is the other reason that it feels like Dennis is a bit more memorable than someone like Seth, is that his backstory gets dumped in this kind of pivotal scene, but it's happening so late in the film that it feels more memorable.
Well, and the film isn't, I mean, because look, this is still a convict. He's still, I don't even want to say he's a bad man, because he made a very bad mistake while on a 5-day meth high, accidentally killing a guy, but the guy died, what, a year after he shot him?
Yeah, he was in, I think he says he was in a coma and then he passed in the hospital like a year later.
Yeah. And so again, like while going to escape Mexico, the money they are going to get is for him to send the wife of the man that he murdered by accident. And
yeah.
So again, it's like he's a bad man in the sense that he did bad things.
Right.
But he's not a bad person, if that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, which I like as a kind of inversion of where you think this character is going to go when he's first introduced. Because, you know, he definitely seems unhinged. Like, these are kind of, I don't want to say like Bonnie and Clyde, but they're more like a Mickey and Mallory from Natural Born Killers, where you just think, oh, these two are going to be bad news. They're going to be really awful to this quaint Americana couple. And it's not that. Like, Dennis is far more complicated. He's far more interesting. And I think the film is better for throwing it back in our faces about, oh, this dude must be bad, white trash trouble. And instead, well, it's like, no, as you said, he did some bad things, but he's not a bad person.
I wonder if the intent, though, because I do wonder if in another film, because you would think that this character might be the first one to die. So right. I wonder if that was the intent when writing the script or planning this movie. I mean, if you didn't know Shea Whigham at all, which some people don't, if you might start watching this and be like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to get killed immediately.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the only reason we would think otherwise now is because we've seen him in so many things. Although he's still a character actor, and sometimes we cast those people so we can kill them.
I mean, you and I just said we can't figure out what we know him from because he just plays like this guy in the background for so many movies.
Exactly.
And then, of course, God, Polly gets so many good lines. Isn't he just the strangest one-armed convict you've ever met?
I love it. So we do have a bit of a hard turn narratively, because we're having all this great character work. It feels like the group is really bonding. And then Seth just immediately goes, I think temperature has something to do with it.
Yeah. So this is our big final like push into the climax of this film.
Yeah, for sure. So we realize that Splinter is attracted to heat. The hotter the things, the more likely it is to attack. So what we have to do is cool Seth's body down enough that he is actually colder than the outside temperature. That will allow him to sneak by and he can get into the sheriff's vehicle, hypothetically either radio for help or potentially get them into a position where they can rush out and drive away.
Mm-hmm. So his brilliant plan.
So we're going to use fireworks as a distraction because they do give off heat. And Seth is going to lower his body temperature using bags of ice.
And yep, that is honestly, it's kind of on par with the It Follows plan.
Yeah, like it's a bit stupid. It sort of makes sense. Like rationally, if you didn't have all the information and you were just kind of eyeballing it, this sort of makes sense, except for the fact that you nearly have to kill Seth and then ask him to go and do a bunch of things.
Oh, God, I know. This, I mean, look, I'm not a scientist. I don't know really how well he'd be able to move at, what, 93 degrees internal body temperature?
Yeah.
But, oh boy, it does not look fun.
Well, the movie gets a lot of tense mileage out of this because you just want him to move faster, and he is basically doing a zombie shuffle. I will say the moment that got me the most is when he finally gets to the fucking car and he leans in and he doesn't shut the door because he looks to check if he can use the radio or if he can use the keys, of which there are none. And I was just like, at least shut the fucking door so you're protected, because the whole time, of course, his temperature is rising.
Yes. And this is the one really bad CGI shot in the movie. When this thing jumps out of the bushes and starts ramming the car, it is less than a second of a shot, but it is just a purely CGI blob that jumps out of these bushes.
Yeah, he's attacked by a giant pixel.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
So we realize, okay, we've lost sight of the creature until it actually attacks him, and then it disappears again. So we've got to somehow lure it away so that Seth can get back in, or we can revise the plan. So all that to say, this creature more or less attacks Dennis and gets its way into the store, so now we're totally completely fucked.
Yeah, like, so we have lost all safety. Being locked in this box is now is a safety hazard. Okay, I'm saying safety too much, but yeah, so the movie's about to end is what we're getting at.
Yeah, because Polly and Dennis are locked in the freezer. Thankfully, there was a shotgun in the sheriff's cruiser, so Seth manages to get that out. And unfortunately, one of the firecrackers has lit the gas station on fire, as predicted.
Murphy's Chekhov's Law.
Gas station on fire. But we get some really great kind of action, propulsive moments where Seth is really going to town on this creature with this shotgun. Polly has Dennis's gun, so we're kind of attacking it on two different fronts. I think this is all, again, like, you know, the editing is kind of going, so it's sometimes a little hard to understand where everybody is and what's happening, but it's exciting, and we know that there's still a big sense of danger.
It's, you know, I will say it doesn't bother me again, but it's a thing where it's like in a scene like this, which is by nature very frantic, I don't always mind this shaky camera, if only because, though, I can see 90% of what's going on the screen.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, like we may lack some of the nuance in terms of like the geography and where exactly they're shooting it. Like, I never really get a good sense of, did they hit it in a shoulder or a head? I mean, this creature is so misshapen at this point that it looks like a blob of about four different people at this point.
Have you ever seen The Water Boy with Adam Sandler?
Oh, God, many years ago.
There's a whole part where they're eating a snake, and, you know, Kathy Bates is like serving the snake, and Henry Winkler's like, what part of the snake is this? And she's like, well, a snake don't really have no pots, but if I had to guess, I'd say it's his knee.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. There is an amusing moment where Seth manages to shoot the hand into the fire.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's amusing, for sure. So the three of them end up escaping outside, but by this point, Dennis has kind of been doubly infected because in order to get into the convenience store portion of this gas station, the thing essentially bit him on the shoulder. Like, he's very badly infected with splinters on one side.
He's fucked. Like, he's not, fucked. You can't, like, chop off a torso.
Although, I think he has a joke, like, what are we going to chop off now? Or something like
that. Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah. Again, everything these people are saying just feel very real to me. Like,
right.
Very little of this feels like movie manufactured dialogue.
Yeah, like, there's still quips to it, but it's not the, I'm about to die and I'm making a joke. It's resigned action movie dialogue.
It's again, like, if you're not along for the ride by this point, sure, this isn't going to work for you, but, like,
turn it off. You've got 3 minutes left. What the fuck are you doing? So Dennis decides he's going to play the martyr. He's going to hang out and deal with it while they, you know, more or less take a hike. So he shoots the diesel tank. Someone on IMDb helpfully said that diesel only combusts when it's in gas form and this wouldn't do anything. So fuck you. You must be fun at parties.
Fuck, I didn't know that. So I learned something new today. That's my one thing.
I mean, don't trust an IMDb poster.
That's true. I'm just going to go start shooting diesel tanks. Like, look, y'all, it's fine.
IMDb said it would be okay. What do you mean I killed a bunch of people?
With all my guns that I own.
Oh, this is true. You are an American. So anyway, in this movie, this diesel tank does explode, and we do end up lighting Splinter on fire, and Polly and Seth return because Dennis has also been blown to the ground. He gives them the dog tags with the bank code so that they can go and deliver the money, and then they limp off, and he blows himself and the gas station, and presumably the creature up.
Presumably, yeah, sure.
Presumably. This is so quintessential end of a horror film. I kind of loved it. They basically stumble off down a long dirt path as the sun is kind of rising in front of them on the horizon. And of course, we get one final image of it's either the same creature that they ran over or more likely the creature from the beginning of the film. But them splinters are still growing.
Interesting. I actually took it to me it's just another part of the creature because clearly this thing spread. So I just figured it was like, oh, there's more of these things in the forest somewhere.
Right. Yeah. The result is still the same.
Yeah.
Sequel setup. So what you're saying is we get infected and then we die.
Yeah. I do like that Polly and Seth at least get to walk away into happiness, because, again, I like them as characters. I like Dennis, but, you know, there wasn't really a world in which he was getting out of this movie alive.
Unlikely, yeah.
Unless we had those couple problems with Seth and Polly, and then Polly just ditches Seth for Dennis.
Babe, I know it's our anniversary, but we've just been through some shit, and frankly, this guy's better for me, so I'm going to go with the bad boy.
I've always wanted to go to Mexico.
There you go. Yeah. Clearly he's loaded. He's got a bunch of money in the bank.
Oh, yeah. But that is Splinter, everybody. Still really, really good for me. This is a 4 out of 5. Despite its minimal shortcomings for me, I get why people wouldn't like it because of the shaky cam stuff, but this is just exactly what I want out of a creature feature.
Yeah, no, hard agree. I mean, the practical effects are great. You can see them most of the time. The editing feels a little bit antiquated. As I said, it gives off that kind of music video vibe to me. But this is very clearly a low-budget indie film. I don't know how much more we could ask from a film with this production budget that's giving us an original creature design. Like, I just think you need to be a little bit generous. And if you are, this movie delivers with the characters, with the action, with the unconventional plotting.
Well, also thinking 2008, so this is coming out about 9 months after Cloverfield came out. And we know that movie had a lot of complaints about the shaky cam, but it's found footage. So the subgenre lends itself to that format. But right. I wonder if this is also just around this time where we were, and what, Paranormal Activity comes out the same month as this as well. So it's like, if people are just more annoyed.
It was in the air.
Yeah, it was in the air.
It was like diesel gas. It was in the air.
Oh, God. But yeah, let us know what you thought of Splinter. If this was a revisit for you, did it hold up? If this was a new watch for you, are you happy for me and Joe, or are you mad at us?
Are you happy for us? What, is this our anniversary? Are we going to go on a camping date?
Oh, man. But yeah, all right. Well, before we announce what we're covering next week, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at HorrorQueers. Shoot us an email at horrorqueers@gmail.com. Find us on Letterboxd to keep track of all the films we've covered. Go watch our YouTube channel for all of our interviews and conversations. If you want to chat with other listeners, please join our Facebook Horror Queers group. If you want to show us some love, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you want even more content, please support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/horrorqueers. This month, we've got episodes on The Outwaters, HBO's adaptation of The Last of Us, 65, and of course, Scream 6.
Shocker. Oh.
And our audio commentary of the month will be on The Strangers Pray at Night, another lean, mean little film.
There we go. Yeah.
But Joe,
What
are we covering next week?
Well, I feel like we should keep it in the indie vein, but we haven't gone Canadian enough this year, Trace.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm actually going to take us to the east coast of Canada, which for you is going to be very confusing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're going to check out a very low-key kind of horror film. This is a coming-of-age queer horror film called Closet Monster.
Oh, boy. I feel like we've wanted to cover this for a very long time, but we did write an article about this back when we were doing our article, so I think we were trying to get some distance between our viewings.
Yeah, that and, you know, this is a film that I think some people will quibble, like, oh, this isn't a horror film, and for that, I would say, well, you've clearly never been a queer teenager. But I don't know. This one's a bit of an oddity. And yeah, you're right. We just needed a little bit of distance from it.
Well, and everyone, I mean, look, yeah, you might quibble calling it a horror film, but there is undoubtedly body horror in this film.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
So, yeah, until next week, a movie that we are both very excited to talk about, we can cross out Splinter.
Indeed, and cross out Horror Queers.
Mm. Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.